So
Geographic
tonight, the
location.
topic, we had a topic last week, which was, am I missing out? And so we were going to kind of build a little bit off of that. And you probably can guess a little bit from our kind of going around. The idea was talking a little bit about repaying kindness and kind of abiding in a sense of well-being. So I thought one thing we could start with is a brief chant. People were quite happy with the other Theravada chant we did last time, so I thought, okay, we can try another one. And this one, if people see, it says the reflections on universal well-being. If you're online, you probably can see that in the reference text, right there, right?
Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
So here's, so you'll see it says reflections on universal well-being. So if people have not chanted Pali, or not Pali, but chanted the Theravada Abhayagiri Amaravati style, basically the arrow below is going down and the arrow above is going up. And if it's in parentheses or brackets, just one person recites. I'll do the recitation to start it, but everybody joins in freedom from affliction. If you get the hang of it, you can just join in the very beginning for a little bit of time, but it's very simple. Now let us chant the reflections on universal well-being. May I abide in well-being, in
In freedom
freedom from
from
affliction,
affliction,
in
in
freedom
freedom
from
from
hostility,
hostility,
in
in
freedom
freedom
from
from
ill
ill
will,
will,
in
in
freedom
freedom
from
from
anxiety.
anxiety,
And
and
may
may
I
I maintain
maintain well-being in myself. May everyone abide in well-being, in freedom from hostility, in freedom from ill will, in freedom from anxiety, and may they maintain well-being in themselves. May all beings be released from all suffering, and may they not be parted from the good fortune they have attained. When they act upon intention, all beings are the owner of their action and inherit its results. Their future is born from such action, companion to such action, and its results will be their home. All actions with intention, be they skillful or harmful, of such acts they will be the heirs. So welcome everyone again. So I thought just to start out to do a quick review of last week, because some people might be new, and I think it's always good to review what Doug says a little bit, because he is sometimes hard to understand because he goes to abstract space very quickly. So if people remember, last week's topic was, am I missing out? And he spent quite a bit of time talking about a Western philosopher named Lacan. Who talked about that actually preceding, say, that Freudian sense of desire, of kind of trying to satisfy some kind of desire, there's actually a sense of lacking. And he described it was basically how, I say, as a very young kid growing up, we're little kids, and then all of a sudden, we were growing up and we see our image in a mirror. So I don't know if we actually have this experience. Maybe people observe it, or maybe it's just something he came up with in his mind. But basically, the idea was we see ourselves in the mirror and we see this kind of unified self in this mirror. But this actual experience that we're going through is this kind of conflicting range of emotions and tensions and things. And that gap is a kind of a tension, the kind of a tension there that we create. And so to fulfill that, we have a lot of projections and and wants and desires. And so basically there's a sense of a really fundamental sense of somehow I'm not complete, I'm not whole. Actually, this is something we had during the we had a gathering of monastics, Western Buddhist monastics, and last this year was in Sacramento. Last year in 2012, in October, we had a gathering, maybe 50, 60 monastics in the Buddhist tradition. It was actually probably the largest Western Buddhist group in the in probably in the world, because not that many Buddhist Western monastics. But basically, there was a couple of topics came up, and one of the can say the most popular topics was the topic of guilt and a sense of not being complete. It was interesting listening to a lot of the monastics speak about it because they talked about how that was a fundamental problem they had to wrestle with when they came to their Buddhist practice. The sense of not being whole, not being worthy, and not and then feeling kind of this fundamental feeling of being flawed. And I think we have that narrative for sure from the Christian storyline of us falling from Eden and not being complete. And so that was something that they really talked about. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about how one works with that experience of feeling not complete. Because Buddhism comes from a different perspective of a sense that we're actually quote unquote complete. There's quote unquote no self, but that's a little bit more complicated. But the sense is that we're fundamentally not lacking anything, and it's only because of our delusions do we perceive that we need something to fulfill ourselves. And so I think that's a very, very different approach to life than how we're mostly presented life in the world now, where we're usually in some system where we're feeling that we don't we're not satisfied. Basically, the environment is telling us we need something more. We need somebody else is having a better time, and say so maybe you should be doing this or getting that or be in this relationship or get this product and then you'll be a little bit happier. So that, I think that was a little bit of a quick summary of what Doug, I don't know if anybody else remembered what Doug said last week that
Pretty
stuck
good
out.
summary.
Okay, so that's what Doug was kind of talking about last week, which was a sense of lacking. And I thought also, I saw Kien walk in this afternoon. She had a little book called The History of Lack by David Loy. And I believe he's
Yeah,
has a kind of a Buddhist background too.
he's actually in the Zen
Zen
tradition.
tradition. So I was asking Kien maybe could explain a little bit of what she's reading. So this is a book, you may describe it. I have never
Yes.
read it, so I just heard of it.
Yeah, I have to read it for a class. Oh, so much fun. So, it's called, it's the Studies in Lack, and it's talking exactly what you just said about this guilt, this incomplete, how in Christianity, there's this sin, you have this sin, and then you always try to, like, redeem yourself. And he was saying that now, in this day and age, since there's no God anymore, no one believes in that anymore. So what we do is we try to redeem like that sin, redeem ourselves in material objects. Like for example, like money, the coin. The money has become a symbol of status. It's no longer the thing in itself, but more into the symbol. And how, he gave an example of like. Like if you own a Lexus or if you drive a Lexus, it's not because you have the Lexus, it's what that Lexus, how you look with that Lexus, with that car. So we would, it's this sense of never having enough. We always have that sense now.
But can I ask, see, how is that redeeming yourself?
It's because we're always trying to look for something else outside, especially in the material objects. Because before we would like have a God to go to and do like self-sacrifice or do these rituals, but we don't have any of that anymore. So we're trying to replace it with something else. And so there's all and in fame, like in like movie stars, they're always looking for people to adore, basically like them. And when it's there's always that sense of never having enough, because he say that this is a spiritual problem, it's not a material problem. So when you're trying to address it with a material answer, it doesn't work, because you're not addressing it at the core of it. So that's why we're always having this sense of never having enough of anything. It doesn't matter, fame, money, success, all the other stuff, all the other five objects. So anyways, it's interesting book, but it kind of addressed that. But whereas the Buddhist sense, in Buddhism, you have everything, you're whole and complete. So it's just contrast is very interesting. So, and he's saying that from the Buddhist perspective, all that lack, it isn't a delusion. It's the self is a construct. It's not real to begin with. So how could you address something that's not there? So anyways, that was kind of hard. It's a hard book to
It's a
read.
hard book to read. Okay. Yeah, you
Yes.
have. I don't know if you brought it. Did you bring it?
Huh?
You
I
bring?
did not
Oh,
bring it
you
because
bring
I'm
it.
still reading it.
Okay. So if people get a chance, you can take a look at that.
Yeah, take a look at it. It's quite interesting.
The History of Lack. The
But
History of Lack.
actually, it's easier to read his other book, which is more popular. It's called Money, Sex, and Karma.
Money, sex, and karma.
It's
Sounds
really
easier.
good. It's easier to read than the other one. It's very similar.
It
So,
sounds like it's easier to read.
yeah, it is. It is. It's
Yeah.
more
More
fun.
fun. Okay, so well, I was gonna say it's actually a couple of things. One was just to mention what Ken mentioned and didn't quite elaborate on, which she said there's five things, there are five objects. And so in Buddhism we actually list out five objects of desire. I don't know if that's something people are familiar with, but it's actually, I thought it's a very useful list because those are the actual things that we feel we lack. And then we have a feeling of lack and we fulfill it through the five objects of desire. And when I read it, I first thought, wow, that pretty much sums up the entire existence in the world. And the five objects are, okay, first one's wealth, so everything like money, material, all the things that's associated with wealth and money. So that's one area people go for. The next one is fame, and that includes not just like movie stars having people adore them,
Reality
but
stars now.
reality stars. Now, I haven't actually watched any reality show in my life, I think. I
Wow.
became a monk before I
Lucky
became interested in a monastic
you.
life before I started, before those really became popular.
Lucky
Me.
you're so
I heard about
lucky.
them. I heard about those. I heard about the trajectory of that. So then there's, but that's not just fame in the sense of people adoring you and kind of thinking you're important, but rather it's a sense of even within your own social group being respected, being a kind of popular with your friends, So there's a lot of elements of that. It's just a kind of, So that's fame. The next one's sex, which was in that list of things. So money, sex, and karma. So we got those two covered. So then you have the sexual desire, which is very, what do you call it? Not motivating. It's very consuming, but not so much in modern days as much as money. Money probably is taken first place. And then the next one is sleep. So people, that's almost like one way to say sleep and just kind of going to sleep and kind of trying to run away from the world in that way. There's also a sense of like using some kind of, you could say using some kind of intoxicant or something to kind of drug the mind. So you're trying to try to free yourself from the experiences of what you have to go through. So it's kind of trying to short circuit your experience to not deal with what's going on. And the fifth one is food. So for sure, when we are a little bit uncomfortable, we look to food to kind of give us a sense of comfort and stability. It's a very sensory kind of experience. So, as Jen described, also it's a good place to give kindness because it makes people very happy, as Jen described. But it's also very easy if you don't have it, you can start feeling a lot of anxiety and affliction because you see how hardwired we are to have sensory input of that sort that will make us feel comfortable. And so. And you feel that particularly in the monastery because a lot of times these kind of things are more regulated, particularly food and and sleep, and I mean, for sure people are celibate in the monastery, and so all these things kind of are way more restrained. So then you see the desires and afflictions go into strange things. You know, like people get obsessed by shoes or something, or by socks, or whatever the mind goes into. It's pretty interesting. But so you can see that these five are the basic. I don't know if people can think of anything else that they see in society that are kind of, is kind of moving things along. But I think that really sums up generally where that sense of lacking goes, or where the sense of missing, even the sense of missing out comes from. You know, it's the sense of lacking comes, we're just talking about today, also comes from feeling not appreciated, you know, not feeling needed, not feeling like one has a place in the world. Like what Kim was just saying in the past, there was kind of at least a Christian structure so that you have your this relationship with this religious view of the world or the society, and you knew your place in it. And I think in traditional societies that was very much the case. You'd have this place you're in the world, and then so you kind of be in a way satisfied with your place because you didn't really think so much of you'd get anything more than that, you know. But now, I mean, now we actually have lost that structure, not just, you know, in the Christian world, but I think also in the Asian societies as well. We've lost a lot of the structures of the traditional values, and so what has replaced that is a kind of an open space of no expectations, no clear roles, and then that sense of lack takes priority, and then we start moving out of that feeling of lack to fulfill it with material objects, which is what we do in capitalism. And so I think that's it's a very modern phenomenon. The other element of modern phenomenon is that we start having like TV and radio, and so there's a sense of comparison that happens. So another observation we had was as a group this afternoon was actually for young people, if you actually look at the age range, probably, or people can chime in if you see a different experience, that pretty much around like probably middle school or around there, maybe elementary school, that sense of lack actually starts. But before that, as a kid, most kids are just running around having experience in their own mind, just completely absorbed in their lives. So the lack is something that comes on at a certain stage, much more pronounced in our own process. Or you can observe it in kids. You know, they can be upset, but they're not, I think, feeling a deep sense of lacking that they're trying to fulfill in a way that people get when we grow older and start really doing a lot of comparison. So I think that's when it happens. Basically, we start comparing. Oh, that person has more than me. Then I don't have that, and I feel somewhat insufficient. So that's the couple of things we thought of with this topic of lacking. So if you have any thoughts or questions, ask at any time. But
Okay, how about maybe it falls under fame, but like some people seek power over other people, they want to be the leader and all that. Would that fall under fame?
I would say that's probably fame, and it got some got has probably got a little bit of money in it too. But yeah, power is definitely another area, especially in modern society. Power is a big area of people seek after to fulfill. I think the sense of power gives you a feeling like, since other people are listening to you, therefore you're okay. Since other people respect me or actually listen to me, therefore I must be have something important. I must be somebody important. I actually see that in my. I have like that thought every so often. I'm like, wow, that's a kind of weird thought. It's a weird thought. I think I'm important from other people listening to me. Actually, it's always shocking when somebody listens to you, like, whoa, somebody's listening to me. This is kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah, as you were talking about the five desires, I was just thinking like, our kind of like modern collective consciousness, I think we really like we actually are judge the value of humans based on their ability to like to access those five desires. And so it's like if someone is really wealthy, for example, like they'll get a lot more, even if they're not maybe the smartest person or have the most interesting thoughts, like they'll be on the news and like they'll get like a front page on the New York Times, like they have access, because for some, because they've been able to fulfill that desire to such like a kind of exorbitant way, it's like, oh wow, like they must have really figured something out about life. Like they're really good at that, or they're somehow important. But it's like it really creates like a false sense of like who what is valuable
mm-hmm.
in like a human being.
Yeah.
And but we're all sort of like attracted to that. Like mm-hmm. I know for me, like even all like I say those things, like I talk about it and I'm kind of aware of it, but I'll still be like, oh, you know, every once in a while, like, did you see that like Leonardo DiCaprio is like doing something, you know? It's just like it still captures my attention every once
yes.
in, you know,
yeah.
every once in a while. And I still find myself actually like, you know, I feel this a lot, like coming from the tech industry, like
mm-hmm.
and kind of working in that space, like if you're at a party, people want to figure out like who you are, where you work, and sort of like,
yeah.
you know, what value do you have to me in the, mm-hmm. before they'll
yeah.
really give you too much
yes.
attention, you know, it's like,
yeah.
oh, and then sometimes I feel like really slighted, like I'm not interesting to you, so they just like go completely look the other direction, you know, and I'm just like, okay.
Texting is really hard now, but anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas, like, if someone has really succeeded,
mm-hmm.
then everyone's sort of like, oh, what are they going to say next? And, like,
mm-hmm.
I really want their attention. I really want
mm-hmm.
to be their friend
yeah.
or, like, somehow be part of their circle because they have, like, you know, they feel important or something.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. That's a good, definitely
yeah.
a good observation. I think modern times especially, mm-hmm. I think probably the tech is because there's such a emphasis on efficiency and value added, kind of like that's the whole operating paradigm. So you're kind of always in this kind of mode. You start dealing all relationships in that mode, you know, because you're working on technical stuff to try to optimize and try to optimize your life.
Totally. Like this new phenomenon that I've been hearing about of these like biohacking.
Biohacking.
It's kind of like the precursor to life hacking. You know how then it's natural. Okay.
No.
What is it?
The idea is to kind of like optimize your life. So it's like you
might really?
Go,
that's actually a concept.
Yeah, you might go on like a special diet, or you might like take a bunch of supplements, or do kind of like different forms of meditation, or different forms of like body work, or I don't know. It's just like trying to like optimize like how productive or like how good you are at sort of doing life.
Wow.
There's like all these different memes. Yeah.
Well, that is literally what I just said.
Wow.
It is actually there's not even a word for it. Optimizing your life. So you've actually become the machine. I mean, we're actually like the machine that we're trying to optimize. Yeah, so you
wow.
can see how our work actually really influences our mind and what we're doing with ourselves. So the idea was to start with looking at that sense of lacking and where it comes from. And really, I think it comes from the way we view the world. It's actually a fundamental element of that. And that's why I would say in the Dharma, there's actually, people have studied Buddhism at all, there's the Eightfold Path. And the first one of that is right, quote unquote, right understanding or right view. And it's basically, I'll say, what's the framework you're using to understand things through? So that will give you the launching pad for your practice or your spiritual development and your growth. So for instance, if you're biohacking and then you're approaching spirituality in a sense of optimizing your life in an efficient way, you might get disappointed when you find out that, you know, it's not optimizing your whatever you're trying to optimize. You know, because it depends. If it does work, it may be a short circuit your system. You kind of get a bigger perspective on things.
Well, meditation may make you more productive.
It could make you more productive, and that's not always a good thing, depending on what you're doing. So productivity is another major a major narrative for modern society. I see it definitely in myself, the sense that if you're not productive, somehow you're wasting time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you're not productive, then you're wasting time, and you're not fulfilling some role you have or something you're supposed to be doing, and there's this feeling of lacking and quote unquote missing out there.
Or you're like letting down the world.
Yeah.
Somehow, like, shame on me for not trying to make the world better or something. Like,
yeah.
I didn't try to go out there and do something.
Yeah.
It's kind of like socially, it's sometimes hard to be like, I didn't do anything today.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
and yeah. it's okay.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that's nice about the monastery. Okay. You get a whole another perspective on it. Like that's when Doug was usually gives us a class here. He always talks about that. He always makes fun of our group because our group is a very Silicon Valley kind of young adult group that comes in, and he always is making fun of us of how we have this productivity narrative, and we always want to be productive.
And so when it comes to spirituality, like we're like, did we meditate enough today? But yeah. Anyway, so yeah.
But anyways, that I think that's something that we have pretty deep in our psyche, and so actually, the first place to start when we want to deal with that feeling of lack or the feeling of, so we were, the other observation we had was, the question when it comes up in your mind, am I missing out? You're still actually in a good space. Right, reason why is you haven't actually moved into a kind of an affliction that takes over your mind, because you're actually catching your first thought, an earlier thought. You still have probably more emotions that came before that thought. When that thought comes up, it's not very powerful yet. It's a question you're like, huh, am I missing out? And so you could follow it, and if you keep following, then you actually say, I am missing out, because you're probably for sure, if you look at the world, wherever we're doing, we're always going to be missing out. I mean, there's going to be somebody making more money than us, having a better time than us, having more fun than us, enjoying life more than us, you know, having better friends than us. So that whole approach to life is actually not very useful. And so I think where Buddhism refocuses the question, when you ask the question, am I missing out? I mean, quickly you can say, no, I'm not. So you want to just respond to your question, say, no, I'm not. I'm perfectly happy how I am. I don't need anything. You know, Reverend Hung Shi created a little kind of mantra, he said, for the modern times, which I thought is actually very useful. And it starts with, I have enough. And so it's basically, you can repeat, I have enough. His song actually goes, I have enough, I am grateful, share the blessings. That has a Christian, hallelujah. May all be fed, may all things flourish, may all awaken, bodhisvaha. So he has a little tune to that. So if you look online, I'm sure you can find him singing that little chant. And so he used that, combined that with the Veg Source, which is a vegetarian group, and he goes to, and it's like their mantra. So anyway, so that's I think a really useful one of first, if you want to have, because this class is more about the actual ways that we can address these things that they come up in our minds. So one really, I think, useful way of dealing with a thought of a lacking or a thought of discontent is actually just in the consciously in your mind, say, actually, I have enough. Mm-hmm. I'm actually grateful. Share the blessings. So you have something that you kind of recite. And the thing is that thoughts actually have a energy behind them. So you have a wholesome thought. You can think of Buddhism, actually, thoughts are just like actions we take. It's just like if I give something physically or I say something with my mouth. Thoughts we act are actually actions of the mind. So the more we create a good positive action, the wholesome effects follow behind it. We just read in the chant we started with that living beings are the owners of their action, inherit its results. And it's actually the intention that's really important. So a skillful act of, say, a wholesome thought of contentment with real intention is very powerful. Just like a unskillful thought of discontent and feeling lacking that's coming from a sense of insufficiency is very harmful. It can lead to depression or conflict or a sense of neediness and projecting on other people to fulfill something, or jealousy, or you can start a whole life down the path of a harmful actions. So that's one, I think, one response that we really can go for is just to realize how we actually have enough, especially in modern society. When it comes to material things, we have enough. In terms of just activities that we can do and have fun with here in the Bay Area, is we probably have too much. We have enough. Just sitting by ourselves quietly probably is not a bad thing at all in modern times, because we probably don't have enough of that. And I think what the other thing that we spoke about that would be valuable was a sense of of remembering people's kindness, because that's actually something that also shifts the ground of our mind a lot, mm-hmm. rather than from looking mm-hmm. out and saying, well, I'm not getting things from other people in a certain way, or I'm not getting my fair share, or I'm somehow not fulfilled. It's actually see how the world is really supporting us every day of our lives, every moment of our lives. And it comes from, one is material things, but it's emotionally, even people's thoughts, how people interact with us, how things are set up kind of invisibly. So although I kind of gave a very mm-hmm. simple explanation a moment ago, I thought, and actually, if we're really conscious, we actually see there's a lot of invisible things that that people do that we don't see for our well-being. So it's like there's this place, there's this room that's, you know, generally, you know, here we can sit in. But it's not, it's protected from the elements. We have cushions to sit on. You know, Marek set out the cushions today, so it's kindness to do that. So there's a lot of things that happen to us throughout our day that we don't really see. And it's easy just to take the world mm-hmm. for granted, because there's no kind of reinforcement. And he said that maybe the reinforcement people have is, you know, what's the value added to my life from you? And if you have that as your mentality, then you're always going to feel like you're lacking something that you have to go fulfill. And you got to hack your body to be more optimized. And so maybe a little bit better be, wait, you know, actually I have a lot and I'm very happy with what I have, and I can then share what I have with other people. So the idea with repaying kindness is that then the motivation to give or help out in society isn't coming from a space of, you know, I'm really helping people. But it's just a recognition of kindness, and you're just carrying that energy forward in society. So I think that's something that's really important for a start of a spiritual practice, is a kind of a recognition of where we come from, all the things that we are building on in our lives to begin the practice. And I think that really takes away the sense of lacking, because you realize how much we have. It's not, I mean, all of us have a lot here in society. Is there anything else? Otherwise, we can look at the texts, if anybody has anything else to share. Okay, let's just quickly, this one is actually pretty straightforward, so I don't think it requires too much explanation. Both the texts we picked today was from the Theravada tradition, and both are very straightforward. So this one especially is actually a reflection. And the experience with these chants, what I find very helpful is actually when you say a word in the chant, the word is just supposed to point to an experience. So you actually want to bring forth that experience when you're chanting. So when you say, may I abide in well-being, you actually, in your heart, if you can remember when you're actually feeling really content and okay, that's what that experience is. You kind of call forth that experience. It's not just the chants. Chants aren't just, if it's just chanting out loud with your mind and your mouth, it's not really completely connected. So you actually want to bring forth the experience, and that really grounds you. So you say, may I abide in well-being, freedom from affliction, you know, no sense of lacking, no sense of ill will or hostility, no anxiety, no fear, and you're just happy with yourself. So that was actually what one of the monks in their group in the Western Buddhist Monastic Conference said. He always started his meditation like that because of his deep sense of insufficiency that he realized he just has from his upbringing. But the only way he could deal with it is basically starting with that pretty much his whole life. He has to kind of deal with that feeling. So this is something I think is really valuable, is basically to recognize that we actually can be happy, and it's not something, there's no, I think the other problem in, again, I don't want to be negative towards Christianity because I try to be, we're kind of interfaith here. But one of the difficulties I have said that Christianity does create is that almost feeling like sufficient in yourself, there's actually some kind of guilt behind it. You're supposed to, it's almost like noble to be guilty. Catholic, comes from a Catholic country, you know.
Big Catholic background.
So actually, in Buddhism, it's not noble to be guilty. This is considered taking identity from your guilt, and your feeling of lacking, or your feeling of making a mistake or something, or being a bad person. So that's not actually a good thing. There is a good thing, which is recognizing that we did something wrong, and then we correct for it. So there's actually a negative feeling in the mind and the heart when we do something that's, say, immoral, or we do something that's hurtful to other people. We go, ooh, and you feel a little pain inside. And then Buddhism says, that's good. You should feel pain, because that's, you see how we're interacting in relationships, and so you want to be sensitive to that. But the idea is that first you don't cover it. So modern society, if you're not in the kind of Christian framework, in the modern society where we're trying to present this kind of perfect picture of ourselves to other people, we're always kind of on display, but also for ourselves, we are trying to create a projected internal picture of ourselves that's whole and like perfect, kind of like a presentation wise, right? I mean, we have all these like Facebook, and actually I haven't been on Facebook either too much, so I don't really know that world. But it sounds like one of the articles when Doug was sharing with us the other day was that this younger generation is really always in presenting themselves, representing ourselves to the world at all times. And so at the same time, we're presenting ourselves inside. Sometimes we don't want to see those things, so we just kind of cover it over. We don't look at those sensations. So that's one side. Or the other side is we kind of dwell in it. We kind of get lost in that feeling of some negativity. So the idea is, in Buddhism, you just kind of see it, and then you try your best to correct for it, and then you kind of let it go. You don't dwell on it. So the sense of guilt actually isn't a noble thing. It's not something that's really good to hold on to in any way. You just want to let it go. So that's the first one in this, is basically not dwelling in this state of misery or a sense of anxiety or the sense of anger. You know, some people live it. You know, there's also something in the, maybe this is more maybe in Asia, I don't know if there's so much in the West. I guess you do have it too, like Shakespeare has plays about it. But in Asia, you definitely have like the sense of somebody wrongs your family or something. You have this kind of family feud that goes on for like centuries in ancient Chinese culture. So that's kind of like ill will that just constant, or hostility that's constant. So we want to say, okay, let's let go of that. Let's let go of hostility. Let go of the afflictions, and you'll find that you're very happy. So that's the first step. So in Buddhism, we always start with cultivating ourselves first, and then it goes outwards. So even the Bodhisattva path, where we talk about in Mahayana Buddhism, the sense of Bodhisattva who's cultivating the spiritual path to help all beings, it starts with ourselves. It doesn't start with going to try to rescue all beings. We're not very happy ourselves. Just the other night, if you have a chance, actually, there's a really good lecture on Saturday night. One of the nuns from Taiwan came, named Dharma Master Zhuang, and she was explaining how, we often go out and try to help people and it ends up being one big mess because we don't have the wisdom, or we don't have the solidity. You know, we don't have the solidity, so we attach to what happens. So then we get into like affliction ourselves. So if we're not, we don't have wisdom, if we don't have wisdom, then oftentimes the situation gets worse when we're trying to help. And the second is, if we're not solid in ourselves, we get attached to the person. For instance, we get attached to the sense of the person appreciating us or acknowledging our helping them, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we're attached to that, then they don't do that for us, we get afflicted. Or we have all these expectations that, you know, something's supposed to happen that I'm going to like this. I think social justice has a lot of that. And people burn out because, you know, they work this project for 10, 15 years and then the government does whatever, and it doesn't work out. And then people get discouraged. And that happens is when we don't have an inner stability first that we can cultivate. So the first one here is we have the inner stability. And then from there, we go out. Then we can go out to may everyone abide in well-being. So first you have to experience yourself. If you don't have that experience in yourself, then one question would be, how can you actually bring that experience to other people? Because you don't have that sense of grounding in your own process. So you couldn't really bring it to other people. So you first have to find it in your own process, and then you go, okay, so now the first step you can bring it to your mind is, I hope other people will abide in that as well. Before, this is, no actions have been taken right now. You're just in your own mind, radiating out this goodness. And it goes through hostility, ill will, anxiety, release from all suffering, good fortune they have attained. However, if you really look at it, though, if you can actually abide in this kind of way of seeing the world, you'll actually find that all your relationships with other people will change, because they're interacting with you in a very different way. I'm just giving an example from lecture also on Saturday night, because I thought it was a very good example. Was actually the idea of respectfulness. So the nun who was speaking was saying how throughout the daily action in the monastery, so we do, say, a lot of our ceremonies and practices, and we have the Buddha, and we bow to the Buddha, or we bow to our teacher, etc. He says, just imagine if the Buddha was actually there, or your teacher was actually, like, the presence was actually there. It's very different when we were bypassed, when the teacher was there and we bowed, and now when we bow, you know, because it's kind of casual a little bit in our minds. But you can imagine, okay, the Buddha is actually, his presence is actually there, and it's kind of inspiring and compassionate being that you really respect, and you're having that sense of respect to somebody. If you really have that heart, and you every time you bow, then you're planting those seeds. That's what I'm saying, the contemplation isn't just to recite, it's actually to bring up that experience. And so imagine that you do that all the time throughout the day when we're doing our practices, and then when you interact with other people, you also have that sense of respectfulness. And if you bring that sense of respectfulness to all your relationships, fairly quickly your relationships with all those people will change quite significantly. You know, you wouldn't be in a space where on one side, at least they wouldn't feel like you're slighting them. You know, we're not. Or there's another example, which is that one about the value added, kind of going to a the kind of tech meeting, is if you wouldn't, other people won't feel disrespected by what you're doing. If you actually had that heart of, like, I really want to respect everyone. So this is saying, so the thoughts in our minds actually have a huge impact on the experiences we have with other people throughout the day that we don't see. So you don't have to, quote unquote, go out and do a lot of good in the sense of, like, joining the soup kitchen or doing these things, but just actually transforming our mind fundamentally will change the relationships around us as the first step. And then any good we do on top of that is, of course, very good. So the last one, I think, is a very important Buddhist principle, which is basically karma. He's talked about that book's name was Money, Sex, and Karma. So,
yeah.
Karma here is actually also very valuable for the sense of lacking in terms of quote unquote right view, is the sense that everything that happens to us came from seeds that we planted in the past. Now, I don't know, it's a little hard to quote unquote prove, I would say, from a lifetime perspective. Like, okay, because Buddha does talk about previous lives. I can say, well, people can see previous lives. But if we just look at our life currently, or people's lives, we actually really, what we do creates the reality we live in a lot of times. So if we can take responsibility for that, then we actually don't feel like we're missing out, because we know that we just created whatever we're in. And if we want to change it, then all we do is change our way of seeing the world, change the actions we take with other people. You know, for instance, if we're generous with other people, then people will actually very naturally start being generous with us. And so that's how it works. So that's actually, in another way, very liberating, because you start operating from a different space. You're no longer operating from a space of trying to gain some kind of advantage from other people or from the world, trying to get ahead, you know, which is often the mindset, is I'm trying to, like, get the better deal, you know, trying to get a good deal here. And in Buddhism, you never quote unquote get a good deal. It's all, you know, seeds that we plant, and we'll get the mm-hmm. exact result of whatever we plant. So one of the kind of founding principles of this organization was, we're not after gaining personal advantage, which I think is not getting a good deal for ourselves and letting other people have the good deal. give them the long, bigger part of the stick. Or not stick. Give them the bigger part of the pie. Yeah, give them the bigger slice of pie. I'm missing my metaphor. I remember when I was a kid growing up with my mom. She gave me a chocolate bar. I think I was probably 5 years old. And I told the story a couple of times, but I think it describes the experience. And so I broke it. So my mom looked at me. I got very happy. I got a chocolate bar. And my mom said, "Oh, are you going to share any of it with me?" I thought, "Share with my mom? I don't know about share with my mom." Okay, I looked at the chocolate bar. So it's okay. I broke it in half. And then I said, okay. So what do I do? I actually asked some kids. So what do you think I did? Because we were talking about filiality, which is the idea of respecting parents. So what do you think I did next? So, well, maybe you gave her, gave her one. I said, well, not exactly. So I looked at both of them and I thought, gosh, they're the same size. What do I do? I should get a bigger one of them. No. I said, okay. So I took a bite out of one of them and I gave that to my mom. That was my solution to the problem. And that's kind of the operating model throughout my entire life before I actually really met Buddhism, mm-hmm. which was basically, dinner time, mom comes with food, I eat the food, I leave the table, and usually I'm late or something, and my mom has to like nag me to get to the table, and that's it. So it's like, okay, that's the mindset of growing up in America. Where we kind of take our parents in that context, and we don't recognize kindness. We don't see mm-hmm. that kind. We actually take our parents for granted. We actually complain about parents. Mm-hmm. My parent doesn't let me do this or that. While I'll say, actually, in more traditional societies, parents are actually very much respected. And even as a young kid, oftentimes you would first give the best things to the parents. Mm-hmm. So you say, oh, whatever food we have, we offer to the parents. So actually, I think that's one thing I've learned coming to the monasteries, because oftentimes we serve the elders first, the elders go first, or we make offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So there's a sense of making an offering before we eat. So it's a very wholesome thing. So that's for this one. I don't know if people have any other thoughts. Do you want to chime in?
Not right now.
No. Okay.
I had some point earlier.
Oh, you had a point earlier. Well, you can go back and make your point.
Okay.
So the other text that we had, which I thought was valuable, was the Metta Sutta. This is a sutra that describes... on Buddha's words on loving kindness. So this is a sutra that... or sutta, the Pali in the Theravada is called sutta in the Chinese or the Mahayana tradition, since we're using Sanskrit, it's sutra. So in this sutta, basically the Buddha describes what it means to have loving kindness. And so this is another way one gives kindness, is a kind of contemplation. So I thought this was another valuable thing, because sometimes we say, well, kindness is how do we develop it? Well, this is one way. This one, these kind of meditations, these kind of practices. So maybe we can chant this one as well, and then we can look into it a little bit. And I think so. Yeah.
The copies don't have the
tone. Oh, don't have the tone. I have a couple extra ones.
Maybe people would like.
You can share one. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
here.
Yeah.
Three. Wow. You share.
I don't sing, so you can share. Mm-hmm.
You share. You bring it on the web
page.
I kind of remember what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So, we could share.
What page is it on?
It's on page 36.
36.
Yeah. So the Buddha's words on loving kindness. This is actually a really good chant. I would say if you want to memorize anything, this is one of the, I have a very bad memory. This is one of the few things I actually have. Actually, I've never memorized. I don't even know. Fuck. You can have it.
We're in the same thing.
Yeah, 36.
Okay.
36.
Here.
Yeah, okay.
Huh? I don't know how to chant. I can't sing, so. Better pass it to someone
we'll
who knows.
We'll follow along.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise will later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none do anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay. Two extra copies.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, one's fine. Okay. So, this sutta, I think, actually really is a nice one because it actually describes a lot of qualities of what it means to be a wholesome person in terms of our speech, in terms of our actions, in terms of our demeanor. And so I think that's something sometimes we don't quite appreciate in Buddhism. People come in just with meditation as their mindset, is that you don't see this as there's a lot of quote-unquote character elements, kind of like a way one is as a person, that's the foundation for one's spiritual growth. And so if you could actually cultivate these qualities, you'll find that a lot of the issues of, say, lacking, the afflictions, kind of don't enter. They don't enter our minds because we're in a different space. And it allows them. The meditation, in actually many ways, starts when we are not afflicted. That's how it kind of works. It's actually, it helps with the afflictions because it kind of calms them down and lets us see more clearly. But in many ways, actually, in Buddhism, really the meditation starts after we stop having afflictions. And then our mind is calm, and then we can concentrate and see things more clearly and see reality for what it is. So the first step is actually just not having afflictions, not having a sense of longing or a sense of, you know, lacking. And so how we do that is we cultivate a strength of character that is that has these qualities. So so one is being skilled in goodness. One is to know what leads to peace and happiness. A kind of you're skillful. You live an upright life. You know, the actions you take are public minded. I think upright often is a sense that whatever you do, you're not ashamed of it. You know, it's something that's correct and proper. Our speech is direct and true. It's not trying to be beating around the bush, trying to manipulate situations. We try to be not prideful, mm-hmm. which is important. Contented, we were just talking about that. We're easily satisfied. So, you know, it's that something comes to us and we're just happy with whatever we have. That's actually one of the things I actually repeat every morning to myself, is to actually remind myself to be content. So my feeling is that's one of the modern problems, more than in the past, because the modern problem is discontent. So it's very, very easy to get into a state of not feeling that I have enough, or we need something else. So, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. So living a simple life, being wise and skillful, peaceful and calm. So if people have any thoughts or questions about anything, please chime in. Not proud and demanding in nature, not forcing other people to do what I want them to do. Let them not do the slightest thing the wise would later reprove. So this is actually an interesting contemplation. Is that first we have to think of who are the wise people in the world. So there's actually a little bit of an external, because we don't talk about Buddhism, kind of internal, using only your own standard and not relying on externals. But here you actually have a sense of an external structure that you're looking to. You're looking to those who are wise, those who have some virtue, mm-hmm. and you're seeing what their standard is and say, okay, so am I living up to their standard? What it means to be a good person. And so that takes a little bit of, hopefully you have some wise people in your life. You can find some people that you respect and you think are people you admire for the right reasons. You know, they're not you don't admire because they're just successful in the world in the sense of material success. They might be successful in the world because they lived a good life and they're a very upright, moral person. So then you can actually think, oh, sometimes I do something and I know for parents actually it's one mm-hmm. one area is, oh, I knew if my parents knew I did that, they'd be disappointed in me. You know, mm-hmm. that'd be something that would be the experience, is basically realizing, using that experience or that feeling to spur us on in developing wholesome qualities, is I would say how that works. So
I find that also in like a community sense, like if I spend, you know, like a week in a Buddhist monastery.
Yeah.
And I'm just surrounded by a culture and a community of people who are like wise and trying to live kind of very intentionally. And then when a piece of the outside world, like I notice this actually, if there's like a bunch of visitors who are kind of coming as tourists to this one temple I've been going to for a couple of years. And it's like shocking to me the juxtaposition I feel that in normal life I would never notice. Mm-hmm. But in the context there, it's like, and it shows me sort of my own kind of complacency with like those characteristics. But like when a tourist comes in and they're just kind of like very, I can just feel them sort of being more absent-minded than the culture is there. Or being kind of like overly sexualized, like women wearing like really high heels and being all like, trying to be pretty or something like that. And normally I walk around and I'm completely surrounded by that culture and it doesn't really register with me, but being surrounded by that community allows me to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that's when I get the strongest experience of that.
Mm-hmm.
is more so in a community space than one individual in my life.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. I think there's probably two elements. One is they say sometimes there's a horizontal relationship and there's also a vertical relationship. So they say there's spiritual friends who are on the horizontal plane of peers who kind of are supporting and kind of urging each other on. There's also a kind of vertical where you have a good role model or teacher and kind of correct and guide us. So yeah, I think that's really true.
One thing about this, about, you know, this line that the wise would later improve, and what Dharma Master shared about kind of imagining what certain people that we consider wise or respect, how they would view our action. For me, actually, you know, a lot of times, like, I do have a sense that those I consider wise would actually reprove a certain action, but there's almost like somehow my mind overrides that, or I in the moment I just ignore that, and then over time just learning that usually when I ignore that, the result is not good. The result is undesirable, and then kind of just slowly learning to like trust that voice a bit more, even though it may go against my desire in the moment or whatever it is. That's been that's really challenging, but it's been important.
Yeah. So wishing gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. And this, all these types of beings, including the invisible and the seen, so all sizes, those who are not strong, those who are weak, that's about those who are close and those who are far, those who are not yet born yet, so even the ones that are coming to be.
They really cover
everybody. They try to cover everybody as much as possible. All beings be at ease. Yeah, they can contemplate outwards. So there's no one, all, even the people you dislike, they hopefully they can be happy too. So you can't hold any grudges. No grudges. Yeah, no grudges. So let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. I always like this contemplation, which is basically a mom protecting her child. And we can always have that image pretty strong, and how pretty much a mom protects her child, pretty much willing to sacrifice everything. And so that with that kind of heart, we try to cherish all beings. Pretty high standard. Pretty high standard. So even those people you don't like, you have to think, well, if I were to really care for them. So radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, going outwards. There's no hatred, there's no ill will. Whether we're standing or walking, seated or lying down, so all the ways that we can be as a person, either we're moving, walking, or we're standing still, or we're seated, or we're lying down. They say those are the four deportments. So that's why it kind of covers every action of the day. We're free from drowsiness. We can maintain this recollection. This is a place. It says sublime abiding. Actually, I think in the original it says the Brahma Viharis, which is where the gods dwell, where the Brahman gods dwell. They dwell in this kind of state of kindness. And we don't have fixed views, which is a big, interesting topic, but maybe
it's called old age. That's
called
what
old
Douglas
says. That you get fixed into a view and then you kind of keep trying to defend that view and that particular way of seeing the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is really important. One thing I really like about Buddhism is you realize all my opinions and views are actually not valuable at all. And whenever I have a thought, I'm right, you're wrong, and well, something's wrong in my mind. You know, whenever I see my mind do it, which it does, you know, it does for sure. I was one of my, I don't know who asked my best friend when he came to visit me when I was at the Sit on the Buddhas. I don't know if you asked him. Did I? I don't know. One of my best friends would say, said, what was I like before I was a kid? Well, he was really opinionated. Which is true. I got a lot of arguments when I was, as a kid growing up. Everyone said, you're so argumentative. No, I'm not. I see your arguments. I say, that's not fair. So, but my sense is actually whenever we actually have that thought in the mind, I'm right, you're wrong. For me, it's an actual kind of like I have like a little flag that goes, ding, something's wrong in my mind. If I have that thought, because, we shouldn't have quote unquote fixed views. It's something's up in my mind. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So then, when in this sense is liberated entirely. So this is one path to liberation is actually cultivating through the practice of this kind of boundless contemplation of kindness. But to round this out though, because this is coming from the more Theravada school, is that in the Mahayana school, I would say the next step would be you're freed from the sense desires, and although you're freed from needing to be reborn again, because you're not so enmeshed in society, in the world, but because you've actually developed this kindness, not just from the sense of a mental state, but actually from a sense of a commitment to saving or helping beings, you actually are born back into this world to help people. So you come back and you out of this sense of deep kindness, you take actions to help them out of their suffering. So
That was a question or
okay. So now it's pretty open. Those are the two texts I wanted to just share tonight as a mechanism for practice.
This is an open question. I don't know quite the answer actually, so it's not a leading question. But okay. Is the state something that is actively recollected, kind of like something you work on as you contemplate, or is it a natural state, kind of almost like as a human being, like as if you clear out and have no affliction, it just naturally arises?
Which state? Kindness? Kind
of what they describe
or
here.
Or will. The sense of contentment.
Or just this whole, I think, kind of what they describe, this sense of kindness toward living beings, this very gentle, very open, very wide, caring and kindness toward living beings. Is this something that comes naturally as you kind of are practicing and still your mind and are free of afflictions and have contentment?
I think it's a practice.
Okay.
It doesn't come naturally. You have to practice it. I mean, certain markers come naturally for certain people, but certain stuff, like for me, I have to really practice some of these mark. To me, they're markers. I could use that. Oh, do I do this? Oh, huh. So yeah, somewhat easier than others. I mean, more natural than others. So it is a practice. Well, for me, anyways.
You're gonna say something more?
My English is limited.
It's okay.
Your English is quite good.
Yeah.
I think this is the way to open heart, step by step. But it's interesting that this practice metta, we started from yourself.
And
after that, we share it for all beings.
Yeah.
Interesting one. Times Ajahn Navarro comments, Ajahn Sumedho also, that it's okay, I can do really easy metta for all beings except one person, my ex. the most difficult. You know? And yeah, this is interesting. But also, I really like, because I'm last time lesson talks Ajahn Amaro, he said about metta. It's not exactly that we should be like all people sense of I like you, it's really good, but that he said dwelling in non-aversion or
non-aversion
non-aversion or or to create some radical acceptance, you know, because sometimes some people are so bad for us,
mm-hmm.
and okay, it's happened, you know, and it for me is try still develop some attitude welcome, you know, for everything, you know, what's happened, and, yeah.
Okay. Any questions online? I realize we've left them out. If you have any questions, you can ask. We'll probably wrap up very soon. To answer Jason's question, I don't know if anybody else has any other thoughts. I don't know if it's the answer to you. I think probably different people have different experiences. So Jane was just saying for her, some things come naturally, some things don't. I think for me, they're similar. Some things are more natural than others. So for some things, if I just didn't abide in the opposite, then the other experience naturally
mm-hmm.
arises. But sometimes it doesn't naturally arise. I'd have to actually kind of actively call forth the experience to go, oh yeah, so this is what I need to cultivate,
mm-hmm.
this kind of experience. I think every time we are kind of planting that seed, that kind of thought, kind of, okay, so I'll say kindness. I would say for some people are naturally kind if they just are not angry or hurtful, to the sense of wanting to care for other people that naturally arises. I think on the ultimate sense, yes. If we just remove all our confusion, then our kind of pure nature would shine forth, and it's profoundly wise and profoundly compassionate. It's you see the suffering of living beings and just naturally respond with kindness, or want to benefit and help make people joyful. But before that stage, where all our delusions are still operating, to actually see where we're weak on, we kind of actively cultivate those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, every time I think read this sutta or I hear it, and I think the first time I heard it was a while back ago, and every time it's extremely inspiring. I go, oh, that's right. Wow, I should really do this. You know, and I guess like I'm trying to figure out what the best way is to kind of at least practice or realize something.
Take one
of these.
They're really good.
Yeah, they're all very good.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
I think we may at one point recite it before we started our meeting.
Mm.
That's one of our rituals. I mean, that'd be a bad ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, this sutra is interesting because it does take you out of the self and just, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
expand
mm-hmm.
out to the world. So I'm thinking, like, how could you feel any lack when you, because
mm-hmm.
yourself is not there. It's like when it's out there expanding to the entire world, it's hard to feel like you're missing out when you're actively being busy, like, you know, practicing all this.
Yeah,
you really don't have time to feel sorry for yourself, really.
Good.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you really put this into practice, each one of them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is pretty good.
It kind of reminds me of like what we were talking about last week. I don't remember what it was called exactly, but like these stages that like something that are like kind of afflictions go through.
Okay,
oh, yeah.
You know, like first
yes.
you're upset and then
yeah.
you're,
yes.
you know, annoyed mm-hmm. and then you're like.
Yeah, the host and yeah. The
yeah.
Guest.
Yeah.
And yes. then you get to the point where you're like, you
uh-huh.
try to repress it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I thought a lot about because I was like, oh yeah. And I think when I first heard the precepts for the first time,
mm-hmm.
I was like trying to like correct my behavior and like kind of notice those things, but then also like I wanted to be the person who was like following the precepts, so I'd kind of like repress
mm-hmm.
repress it.
Yeah.
I guess I really still do that, but it stands out to me then. And then interestingly how that leads to arrogance, because then you're like, oh, you have to like put yourself out there because you actually are mad at yourself for sort of like not really doing it, like lying.
Yeah.
And repressing it, so then you become kind of arrogant and sort of like maybe like project on other people like your own sort of personal dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to kind of like take this, like I really liked what you were saying about, you know,
making this like a thing you kind of recite in the morning or like at the end of the day. So it's like before you even get down the line, you're kind of like, how can you like stem from this? How can your thoughts like come from here?
Yeah.
Versus trying to like correct it when it's already like so far down.
Yeah.
Which I guess is good as long as you, like you see it at some point, but even better if you can like.
Yeah, it's better if you don't. We were having that discussion in the meeting today. We were like, this helps you actually not fall in the hole.
Yeah.
When you're actually in the hole, we're like figuring out it's a little bit hard to get out. You're doing, what can you do to get out of the hole? Yeah. So it's just it's kind of like, okay, there's a hole there. Don't fall in. Okay, well, there's nothing else we have about 9:10, 9:12. So is there anything else that we have to...
Do we want to bring up...
Yeah, well, actually, one other thing we can bring up, which is recent this relatively small group, is we were thinking about potentially at one point, maybe not this week, not next week, maybe 2 weeks from now, maybe... The last class of this semester, which is
might be May 12th,
was that if people would actually be interested in kind of gathering beforehand. And there's a couple ways to do it. We can have a little bit of food if we like, or we can just kind of have some tea or something, and just kind of reflect on the semester a little bit and see what would be valuable to do, say, the following semester, and say fall, or even if people would like to do something in the summertime, what kind of activities people would like to do. I think the intention of this class was, this is also online, if you guys have ideas of how to improve it, you can email Jason, or you can come up. You can come for one special time, for some people who are from the somewhat area nearby, not New York, but probably if they're from San Francisco. But the idea of this class was kind of trying to find some ways that we can make Buddhism connect to the modern experience. And so what we're trying to do was just take the sutra text, the primary text, and then have kind of modern topics that it connected to. So that was the kind of model of it. But we're very open to seeing what we could do in the future. And we were really also thinking about potentially creating a bit of a kind of a community around it. So it's not just like a class, but you know, maybe this kind of community events or some kind of way that people can plug into something. We're thinking of at one point of doing some kind of online forum or some kind of community website, if that's useful. We're kind of not 100% sure either way yet. So people have feedback or are interested in helping support that or something like that, let us know. Or you can email me. I think we can see if we can do something. So that's kind of the project. So I don't know what people would see. If would people be interested in something like that? If they would come maybe 20, 30 minutes beforehand? Or we do like a little snacks or and tea or something. You're in the bowing session, I know. You won't be around. So you can be bowing. It's a good exercise, good practice for sure. Okay, so we'll see. We'll email out and let people know about that. And if people have any thoughts, please let us know because the semester's almost ending and what we can do next semester is definitely an open field.
Okay, good night.